Hello and welcome back to the Rust Belt Risters podcast. My name is Andrew Roman. Last week, I introduced the concept of strong link theory, the notion that elite talent has a greater impact on the success and failure of hockey games than the failures and mistakes made by quote-unquote bad, weak link players. Now that we know that hockey is in fact a strong link sport, let's take a look at the implications of these links on the Pittsburgh Penguins. My intention here is to try to go through basically the entire roster, but in the interest of being brief, I am going to limit it to Penguins on the current season-ending 2018-19 roster, and I'm going to break those guys into three groups. So we have low-tier contracts that are worth between the league minimum and $2 million, mid-tier contracts worth between $2 million and $6 million, and top-tier contracts that are worth more than $6 million. While I did pick these values more or less arbitrarily, they are actually pretty balanced. We have 10 players in the low tier group, 9 players in the mid tier, and 4 in the top tier. Since it's the smallest and easiest to talk about, let's start with the top tier. The list of top tier players consists of Evgeny Malkin, Sidney Crosby, Chris Letang, and Phil Kessel. And guess what? At least in one way or another, they all fit the bill as elite talent, even during the 2018-19 season. Crosby is entirely unimpeachable. He turned in a 100-point season while fully embracing the transition to being the true shutdown center on the team, playing every game against the hardest matchups. The only problem for Sid is that he scored too many points to earn what would have been a very well-deserved Selke nomination this year, but he also probably focused too much on defense to probably have a serious chance at the Hart Trophy, although he has been named a finalist for that one. From this point on, though, you might want to ask, but what about all those other guys? I've been told they're all just bums who need to run out of town on a pole because of a few bad playoff games, right? That might be true if you're Jacques Lemaire or Lou Lamoriello or John Tortorella or some other fun-averse coach or GM or whoever the case may be. But the reality is that all three players had good, if not objectively great, regular seasons. Maybe Malkin did take too many penalties, but he also had 76 points in 72 games. And Letang, for his part, tied his career high in goals with 16, recorded the second highest overall points mark in his career with 56 points in 65 games, and he seemed like a Norris frontrunner until injuries derailed the end of his season. Looking at Kessel as well, he is as durable as they come, finished the season with a cool 82 points in 82 games. He did score 36 of those points on the power play, and while a cynic might say that's overly dependent on power play production, it also means that he is genuinely one of the very, very best in the game at it. Now, for some negative context, all three of Malkin, Kessel, and Letang did test out as negative defensive wins above replacement players, yet they all finished with overall positive WAR scores. Teams pay a premium for elite offensive output, and the Penguins got exactly what they bargained for from all four of their top-tier contracts. Before I move on, I will reiterate some of the points I made last week, specifically about Phil. The more I delve into the numbers, the more comfortable I get with the notion that if you're going to trade one of these players, it should be Phil. Looking more granularly at his goals above replacement figures, Phil netted a GAR over 82 of 0.18, meaning that he basically only created about 1/6 of one more goal than the average replacement level player would have produced. And all of that despite scoring 82 points in like 27 goals. I'm telling you, his defensive metrics are not good. If there is a way to upgrade at that end of the rink, it's probably worth doing. Similar to the top tier contracts, I don't really have all that much to say about the low tier contracts on the Penguins roster. As I talked about last week, typically cheaper, quote-unquote, worse players don't see the ice often enough to negatively impact too many games. Further, I would argue that if low-tier contract players are getting exposed, it should be a fairly simple adjustment from the coach to insulate those players better. Ideally, low-tier contracts should be a mix of overachieving up-and-coming young players on entry-level contracts or bridge deals, plus average depth from veteran players looking to rebuild their value, and typically it will be rounded out by a few part-time AHL, NHL tweeners who can contribute a handful of good games each year. The Penguins definitely had a trio of overachievers in Jake Guentzel, Jared McCann, and Marcus Pettersson this past season, and we should give Jim Rutherford some credit for these players. He drafted Guentzel and made smart trades to acquire both McCann and Pettersson. I won't focus too much on this point, but Guentzel, with his 40 goals on a contract that paid just $700,000 last year, boasted the best wins above replacement output of any Penguin player this year, and he finished with the 8th highest score in the entire NHL. He was worth 4.73 wins above replacement. Unfortunately, though, we already know that Jake Guentzel is going to be making over $6 million next year, and Marcus Pettersson is also an RFA and will be due at least a little bit of a raise, maybe up towards, you know, a little north of $2 million or somewhere in that range. And then following up a year behind them is Jared McCann. So it is essential to keep this type of pipeline going into the future, but the Penguins seem to be really thin on developing that next wave of good new talent. The next group that I'll identify here is Teddy Bluger, Zach Aston-Reese, and Dominic Simone. All three are 24 years old, and they still have like a fairly small, narrow window to improve. ZAR and Bluger are RFAs this offseason, but due to a variety of factors, I don't really think they should be in line for more than minimal raises above what they're currently making, which is probably right around league minimum. All three players really ideally project as third or fourth liners, and I think they all fit that role well. These are perfectly fine contracts as far as I'm concerned. The Penguins have already made smart, low-risk investments into Casey DeSmith, Chad Ruedel, and Juuso Riikola to preserve the depth in goal and on defense. The years of control and continuity for these players, who may or may not ever develop into full-time players, makes these contracts perfectly fine. I guess I will just take a moment to remind everybody that Juuso Riikola is actually 25 years old, and although last year was his first year playing hockey in North America, he is not your kind of quintessential rookie player. He might be kind of towards the top of his development window as it is. Riikola does seem to offer at least maybe a little bit of a higher ceiling than a guy like Chad Ruedel, but at this point, it's probably presumptive to say that he's ever going to become like a true regular NHL starter. Finally, as far as regular contributors to the lineup who fit into this low-tier category, we're left with Matt Cullen and Garrett Wilson. Both are pending unrestricted free agents, and realistically speaking, they would represent no great loss if they decided to sign, or in Cullen's case, retired somewhere else. Cullen is 42 years old, and while he still kind of looks the part of a hockey player, there's no question that his effectiveness is not what it used to be. He was one of only four regular starters for the Penguins this year to post a negative goals above replacement with a negative 3.6, and I think it makes sense to pass the baton at this point to the much younger Teddy Bluger. Wilson, who was a career AHLer until this point, was something of a pleasant surprise in terms of his effectiveness as a possession driver and a dependable penalty killer, but it would be negligent to project that his role can be added to or enhanced in any sort of meaningful way. And so now we come to the mid-tier contracts. And this is where things do get a little bit dicier. Look, mid-tier contracts are, by their very nature, the hardest to negotiate, and even more so, they're the hardest to get right. As a general manager, you are explicitly identifying that these players, most of whom are veteran players who have reached the collectively bargained unrestricted free agency years of their career, are worth more than low-tier contract players, but you're also making an open acknowledgement that these players fall short of being worth that elite status contract, you know, up over $6 million. It's imperative that you spend these dollars especially wisely, because ultimately this is likely to be the largest piece of the pie when you're cutting up the salary cap. Further, it's typically more difficult to shelter these players, as they either will likely need to play in a complementary role to the elite talent on the team, or they will need to lead their own line with other mid and low tier players. And so for many of these players, they cannot rely solely on the presence of the strong link player to shoulder the bulk of the responsibility. Ultimately, up to this point, we haven't actually had to focus that closely on the distinction between strong and weak link players. I mean, if you can't really tell, I kind of judge all of the top tier players, the Crosby, Malkin, Kessel, Letangs, as strong links. And I also identified Jake Guentzel, Jared McCann, and Marcus Pettersson as strong links, while I kind of viewed everybody else, in that kind of low tier of contracts as more of a weak link type player, albeit some are closer towards a strong link status than others. But this distinction between strong and weak link players is much more important amongst mid-tier contracts. I don't think it's unfair to say that really good teams who consistently make the playoffs and compete for championships can consistently rely on players with mid-tier contracts who can still deliver strong link-like performances. Thinking critically about this, I think it is important that second and third pairing defensemen, as well as second and third line centers, should be strong links in the chain for teams with championship aspirations. Depth down the middle is often cited and proven to contribute to success for teams, and the more strong links they can build down the middle, assuming that they, you know, ultimately have elite talent on the first pairing and on the first line, the better the chances for success. From a certain point of view, the Penguins have done well in that regard. Brian Dumoulin is unquestionably a fantastic number two defenseman, and he is locked up for years, and he comes at a fairly favorable contract number. And while he is a complement to Chris Letang on that top pairing, this is not an instance where Dumo's performance is a product of Letang's. In fact, Dumo's WAR over 82 is actually higher than Letang's, and it's entirely predicated on his defensive wins above replacement and his ability to shut down his side of the ice, while Letang derives his value from the offensive end of the rink. Erik Gudbranson was perhaps the biggest surprise of the season for the Penguins, contributing pretty favorably to the team's transition game and suppressing shots at a very high rate while being, you know, utilized in a second pairing, third pairing type of role. Another mid-season acquisition who filled what had been a pretty disappointingly glaring hole was Nick Bjugstad. While his offensive outputs may never reach the numbers he produced early in his career, Bjugstad was an absolute possession monster who helped turn the Penguins' third line into a cycling machine. He wasn't blessed to play with much of an elite finisher, but he did turn a liability into a strength for the Penguins down the stretch. Finally, to round out our examination of strength down the middle, would be Matt Murray. Murray certainly had his struggles in the early part of the season, and his durability does remain something of a concern. But realistically speaking, the guy spent the first quarter of the year as one of the very worst starting goalies in the league, and by the end of the season had ended up somewhere in the top third of the league. His 1.99 wins above replacement places him third on the team, behind only Crosby and Gensel, and that was while playing in only 48 games. Extrapolating his wins above replacement over 82 numbers puts him second behind only Gensel and ahead of Crosby. Figuring out his next contract will be a very interesting storyline to watch this summer and into the next season. I'm going to put Justin Schultz into a category all of his own for three separate reasons. First, this season was a challenge as he was limited to just 29 games, but his offensive value continued to be pretty good with 15 points in those games. Secondly, despite his offensive contributions, Schultz's overall value was not very high. Both his overall WAR and more granular goals above replacement scores were negative. I think the biggest part of that, though, comes from his most common defensive partners. And three, we do have consistent evidence that Schultz has been a positive performer for the Penguins during his entire stay here. Reading too much into less than 30 games this year really wouldn't be all that helpful. I mean, this is a, you know, quintessential number three offensively minded defenseman. He helps a lot on the power play, and he does his job pretty well. He just didn't get to play a whole lot this year. So ultimately, that leaves us with four players who, in my estimation, don't really deliver value commensurate to their contract. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that these are bad players or that I hate these guys, but if I could draw a continuum of weak to strong link that followed a linear path based on salary, all of these guys would look like their chain link was made out of a brittle metal compared to the others around them. And so those players would be Patrick Hornquist, Brian Rust, Ole Mata, and Jack Johnson. In the defense of Hornquist and Rust in particular, these are the two players that I think I personally would be most interested in trying to trade this summer. They have good value, but I also believe that the value that they bring to this current Penguins team can be replaced for less cost. Hornquist and Rust might be victims of their own success. They're both fairly flexible and quite literally played up and down the entire lineup this past season. When they had a chance to skate with a Crosby or a Malkin, both players showed that they could chip in points, and further, Hornquist arguably looked his best when he was skating with Simone and Bjugstad on the third line towards the end of the season. But for both players, they aren't really good enough to drive a line on their own, but they're getting paid as though they are at that level. It's also true that when I look at a player like Patrick Hornquist, I truly believe that some of the other variables I described last week, and also to that extent some of the things that I've talked about when talking about Phil, hold salient to Hornquist. He's an older player, he's been somewhat injury prone, especially with concussions, which are obviously a different type of threat, and he is fairly dependent on the power play to earn his points. Also, unlike Phil, who continues to produce on the power play at an extremely high level, the problem with Hornquist's reliance on power play productivity is that Jake Guentzel has pretty well and truly supplanted him as the best net front specialist on the team, meaning that Hornquist's power play opportunities will probably continue to decrease. This will probably sound unduly harsh towards Brian Rust, but his playing style, I think, is one of the easiest to replace on the open market. Yes, he's very fast, he's a tenacious forechecker, and he's also extremely streaky. There have been a lot of players like Brian Rust in the past, and his is a skill set that I just don't think you need to actually pay $3.5 million per season for. As for Olli Maatta, his is a bit of a cautionary tale of projection, which was a topic from last week if you haven't listened to it. When the Penguins offered him his current long-term $4.1 million a year deal, they thought for sure that he would consistently play to the level he had shown flashes of being during his entry-level contract. They thought they were getting a top-pairing defenseman for second-pairing money, and they were buying years of control. In reality, Maatta would probably ideally be a really good number 5 defenseman on a team, and maybe that team isn't even the Pittsburgh Penguins. Concerns surrounding his health and durability, as well as his continued skating struggles, have made it pretty hard for Maatta to look like a natural fit on this current roster. As far as links are concerned, Maatta is in a unique spot. He tends to play to the exact level of his defensive partner. He's almost like the anti-Brian Dumoulin, if you will, making him perhaps the ultimate weak link in a sense. If he needs to play top minutes, he tends to excel and he plays well, but if he gets saddled with a subpar partner, they tend to both go down together. And that leaves us with Jack Johnson. It was a tough season for Johnson, made worse by his fairly negative media perception because of his bloated cap hit and the 4 years of term remaining after this season. And I'm not saying this from the subjective point of view, I am saying this from the point of view that he finished dead last in both wins above replacement and goals above replacement for the team, and he was one of the most consistently below replacement level players on a rolling average in the entire league, despite appearing in all 82 games this season. I had this conversation over the weekend with former co-host Mike Swanson, and he argued that taken in isolation, Johnson doesn't actually really make that much, and that he alone didn't sink this current Penguins team. There's a lot of validity in that, and as I discussed last week, typically one bad contract can't sink a team. But with all of that said, it's this logjam of players that ought to be broken up and replaced with stronger links if the Penguins want to have a chance at another Stanley Cup before the end of the Crosby-Malkin era. Ultimately, these four players represent about 20% of the salary cap, and as I say, they just don't seem to contribute commensurate to that. I mean, I've talked a lot about how strong links are where it's at, and that it's better to emphasize strong links over quality depth, but I think trying to develop more of that young talent and using this year's first round pick, or even trying to secure a second first round pick this year, would be such a crucial step towards being able to replenish the ranks occupied presently by the Jake Guentzels and Jared McCanns of the world, and find some more players that can fit that mold. I think if you can do that, then you're in a good position, and you can have players that generate high wins above replacement. But until you get back to that point, and I mean, who's to say if maybe an Anthony Angelo or a Jordy Bellerive can fill that role, but right now it doesn't look especially promising. Ultimately, right now, what I think it comes down to is that the Penguins have, you know, potentially one or maybe two off seasons left in which they can try to kind of restructure that lineup and get some of those quality young players that can grow and become strong link players into this lineup. And I think if they can do that, then they have another chance at, you know, greater glory. But if not, then I think, unfortunately, just kind of that inefficient money in the middle is just going to catch up with the team in the same way that it's caught up to the Chicago Blackhawks or the Los Angeles Kings. I mean, yes, it's fantastic that the Boston Bruins made it back to the Stanley Cup Finals basically 8 years after their last Stanley Cup Championship, and they made it back in 2013 as well. But you think about how long it took them, basically 6 years from 2013, to actually rebuild their lineup. And the reality is that there might not be 6 years left in the Crosby Malkin era. We can hope that there is. I mean, I think part of that's going to come down to whether Malkin wants to stay or if he decides he would like to go back to Russia. But I mean, that's a real concern that you don't have time to go through a full redevelopment cycle. But ultimately, I believe that the Penguins can begin to take some major strides towards that this year. And if they're willing to part with a couple of valued and well-liked players, they might be able to find themselves on the fast track towards that regeneration. Thanks everybody for listening. If you liked the show, please consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, RIP iTunes, and also check out the other shows on the Reggie's House Podcast Network. Greedo Shot First, a show that I host with Connor Arlette. We talk about Star Wars and stuff, and also the Games and App Podcast hosted by Andrew Fiak and Brandon Carnahan. They talk about video games, and it's pretty fantastic. We'll catch you all next week.